Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. In the past week, there have been distressing reports of 160 Rohingya refugees left stranded at sea on a damaged boat, running out of food and water. Can and will Malaysia help them? Joining me on the show to shed some light on what's happening right now, we have Lilian Fan. She's the chair of the Rohingya Working Group of the Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. She's also the co-founder and international director of Gotanyo Foundation, which is a regional humanitarian organization based in KL and Aceh, Indonesia. Lilian, thank you for joining me today. I know you're traveling, but I mean, the situation it is developing as we speak. What do you know of the situation as of today, Thursday, the 15th of December? Who's in the boat? How many are there? Women, children? Do they have food? Do they have water? What do we understand of the situation right now?
Thanks, Melissa. What we know is that this boat is carrying around 160 people. What we don't know is how many of those people have died already. So we can't really verify the exact figures. We know that there are men, women, and children on this boat. Some of them are entire families that have traveled together. They have run out of water and food actually more than a week ago, because some of the food that they were carrying on the boat was actually being damaged by the very heavy rains that they were facing, and of course being tossed about at sea in the deep open sea where they've been basically stranded for more than a week. We have heard that the engine of the boat has been broken. The boat is actually leaking as well, and the boat is not anchored, so it was actually literally being tossed by the wind and the waves. We also know that the boats actually change position, so that it was for most of last week actually in a region that was considered Malaysian SAR region, not Malaysian territorial waters. I think that's a very important distinction to make.
Sorry, SAR stands for
Search and Rescue Region.
Search and Rescue Region, okay.
It's actually very far, quite far north into the search and rescue region, which is in the Andaman Sea, and it's bordering the search and rescue region of India as well as Myanmar. And although it's physically closer to Thailand, it was not in Thai search and rescue region either, and not really that close to the coast as well. It's not there anymore, though. So this is where it was up until about early this week. And then we've since discovered that the boat actually has been assisted. We're not exactly sure by who. Some people say it was the Indian Navy, but we haven't been able to verify that yet for sure. But the boat is now in a different location. And in fact, it's much closer to Indonesia. We think still in international waters, but on the area that is really bordering the waters of Indonesia near Aceh. So that is where the boat is currently. So actually right now, we're really trying to call for the Indonesian government to conduct search and rescue for this boat and assist people on this boat very urgently.
Okay, let's talk, we'll talk about the sea rescue limitations and constraints, but I want to understand a bit more about where did the Rohingya people on the boat come from? Where were they? Where did the boat originate from? And where is it thought to be headed?
So this boat is actually one of several boats that left Bangladesh around the same time. They all left around the 25th, 26th of November. And we're seeing a much larger number of refugees, Rohingya refugees, who are leaving the camps this sailing season. So obviously, as we know, Rohingya try to leave every year. There are people who take that risk of getting onto, you know, these rickety boats and taking these very dangerous journeys. But I think what's different now is that we're really seeing an increase in the numbers. Even UNHCR put out a statement to say it's about sixfold, the numbers that we're seeing. And we're also seeing many more families actually taking this boat together. So you're not just seeing, you know, men trying to get to a place where they can find work, you're actually seeing families fleeing. And there's two things. I mean, one, I think, is that we all know that the situation in Myanmar has obviously deteriorated, and particularly in Rakhine State, the fighting has started again between the Arakan Army and the Tatmadaw, the Myanmar military. That has an impact on two things. It has an impact for the Rohingya, I mean. It has an impact on the Rohingya who are there, who are still there in Rakhine State, and also the ability of Rohingya who are in Bangladesh to go back or to feel that they can ever return in voluntariness, safety, and dignity. So it is a moment where you actually see people losing hope in the fact that, you know, thinking that they can't go back anymore to Myanmar, but also the situation in Bangladesh, in the camps themselves, have also deteriorated. So that's very important to understand too. There are security incidents that have been taking place in the camp as well. It's not a secure place. People have been facing violence by armed gangs. People have been experiencing basically this prolonged displacement without any guarantee actually of safety or security as well.
Yeah, I mean, we forget that, you know, some refugees have been in the Bangladesh camps for more than 5 years now. So children have grown up there, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I saw the reports and the statements coming out from UNHCR warning that there's actually rising despair as well as rising violence. I will come back to that. I think it's important to address the protracted nature of this refugee crisis. But coming back to the issue with the boat, something you mentioned a bit earlier about needing to make that distinction between being in territorial waters versus being in search and rescue region. Could you help me understand? Because, you know, when a couple of days ago, when the Malaysian Maritime Enforcement Agency, they said, well, actually, there's no boat. There's no refugee boat that's stranded here in Malaysian waters. What was the difference between their limitations of what they could do to search for it?
They were actually correct. It was not in Malaysian territorial waters, and we had never claimed that. We have always been saying that the boat's location was actually in the search and rescue region. And if you look on the map, it was technically closer to Thailand, but it still fell under Malaysia's search and rescue region, not Thailand's search and rescue region.
So the search and rescue region exceeds territorial waters.
It does. It exceeds territorial waters. It extends beyond. And it's really, you know, the country that confirms to the International Maritime Organization where exactly its area of responsibility for search and rescue is. So this is an area that has been confirmed by Malaysia to the IMO, and it is within our SAR region. The thing is that, of course, it doesn't automatically mean that, you know, we have always the capacity to do that search and rescue. It definitely, MMEA will not have that capacity. It's just too far off the coast where this boat was. So in fact, we were trying to ask the Navy if they could assist in trying to find this boat, because it really was in a location where actually only military capacity would have been able to reach it. Civilian capacity would just not have been able to get the job done. So we don't actually dispute what the MMEA said at all. It's really just clarifying actually where that boat was at the time. And it's not there anymore. So now we really need to start the lobby efforts to the Indonesian government.
Is it very hard to determine where you know, little refugee boats are? I can imagine they're not big vessels. They're small and they're probably barely seaworthy to begin with. Is it very difficult to determine where these boats are, particularly if it's damaged? Is there any communication with how to determine the location or the coordinates of it?
It really depends on how the passengers on the boat are communicating. And whether or not they have means of communication. So this boat in particular, it was really our network within APRIN. There are a few people and organizations that have been able to communicate with the relatives of persons on that boat. And the boat passengers did have a satellite phone on them. And that's actually how they were sending coordinates. And it was very rare, very infrequent. We didn't know when these communications would be sent out, of course, with the weather, the low battery, the kind of conditions that they were in. But when those locations have been received, they are from the satellite phone that is actually on this boat. That's why we know that they are accurate. So then it was a matter of mapping out, you know, exactly where those points were, you know, who sort of had responsibility for that area, and trying to reach out to those authorities to see if, appealing to them to see if there was a way to conduct a rescue of some sort.
Lillian, when the boat was in the Malaysian search and rescue region, did the Malaysian government help or try to help?
So to be fair on the Malaysian government, I think that the response was a little bit mixed. I think number one, there was, I think definitely some lack of clarity on where the boat was and asking for credibility of these reports. But some, you know, some parties in the government did actually take this quite seriously. So the discussions, I think, particularly with MINDEF indicated that there was real concern and that there was a need to understand really more about who had the capacity to do anything about this. There was also, we understand, coordination and communication with Thailand to see if Thailand was going to take responsibility for conducting a search. Thailand did actually conduct a search and they told this to Malaysia. So that's one of the reasons why Malaysia, for a few days actually was saying, you know, the Thais are taking care of this. The Thais are actually going to do a search and possibly a rescue as well. The problem though, is that Thailand didn't find the boat. The Thai Navy has now said this, that they actually went to look for the boat and couldn't find it. And also perhaps didn't go out as far as was necessary in order to be able to get to that location. So in the end, the boat was not rescued by the Thais. It took some time before Malaysia realized that it wasn't rescued by the Thais. I heard that actually our Navy did send surveillance out to look for this boat. Well, the military did. So I think between the Navy and the Air Force actually did send out surveillance to look for the boat. By that time, the boat had already moved. So they didn't find anything. And the boat is now in a different location, still in, you know, in the sea. It hasn't been disembarked yet. People are still in very desperate need, still very much in need of assistance, urgent life-saving assistance, but they're still not getting it. And I think this is our big concern right now. You know, it's not, it's still not clear who's going to be able and willing to do that rescue, which is so urgently needed right now.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but let's come back and continue this conversation. There's still quite a lot to cover, particularly as this is quite a pressing story. We'll be right back here on Consider This. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for staying with me on Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris and I'm speaking tonight to Lillian Fan. She's the co-founder and international director of Catania Foundation. She's also the chair of the Rohingya Working Group at the Asia Pacific Rights Refugee Rights Network. Lillian, can I ask you about the 2015 Andaman Sea crisis? Maybe you can refresh our memories as to the terrible tragedy that happened then and what we learned from that tragedy, because as you pointed out a bit earlier, there seems to be yet another boat crisis developing. Maybe you can tell us, refresh our memories as to that tragedy.
So 2015, what we refer to as the Andaman Sea crisis was really a situation where boats of Rohingya refugees that had come basically were trying to bring Rohingya from Bangladesh and Myanmar to the Southeast Asia region, got stranded and got stuck basically at sea because of the discovery of mass graves on the border of Thailand and Malaysia in the Wan Kalyan area. And that triggered basically the authorities, particularly the Thai authorities, to really crack down on trafficking. And they put very, very stern blocks basically on any kind of, basically infiltration of the border. Traffickers realized they were not able to disembark the boats that easily as they had in the past in Thailand, and therefore their route was disrupted. This caused the smugglers and traffickers to actually abandon the boats at sea and really leave people in these boats without water, without even anyone to captain the boat. And with boats in conditions that were extremely damaged as well. So you basically had Rohingya refugees stranded at sea, and there were a number of boats, so about five or six boats at the time. This is very similar to what's happening now. You know, there have been about five boats out at sea. Not all of them have been in such serious distress. One was picked up by a Vietnamese oil vessel and handed over to the Myanmar Navy We've heard that they've since been imprisoned, so this is, you know, very worrying as well. But others, you know, basically this particular boat has gone into very serious distress and started issuing distress calls about a week, more than a week ago. And there have been others where we just don't have enough information. There have been some reports that there's another boat somewhere in the Indian Ocean, which is also in distress, but no clarity really on too many details on that. The problem is, though, the regional response, you know, what does that look like? And I think that we haven't learned regionally, you know, really how to respond to crises of this nature. We see this every year at a different scale. I think why we are comparing this crisis to 2015 is because of the scale, the number of boats, the fact that we're seeing multiple boats, you know, potentially in distress at the same time, the ping pong, what Human Rights Watch calls, you know, basically the maritime ping pong of basically, you know, countries going back and forth. We haven't seen as clear, you know, this kind of pushbacks as we did back then, but we also wouldn't be surprised if that happened because that is the policy now of a number of countries.
Right.
So countries really not taking any responsibility or trying to avoid taking on that responsibility of conducting disembarkation.
Wasn't there the Bali process that came out of the Andaman Sea crisis?
So the Bali process existed, and the Bali process basically, in response to the Andaman Sea crisis, developed what they called a consultation mechanism, which could be activated in the event of a similar crisis happening. We've seen smaller scales of boat crises in the last few years. We've seen this current boat crisis right now, and we have not seen any indication that countries who are members of the Bali process are using this consultation mechanism, which is really unfortunate because that is a regional mechanism that exists precisely for crises of this kind. And it really should be a way that, you know, countries should be coordinating with each other in a little bit more of a holistic way, you know, not just navies talking to each other, but actually, you know, governments really speaking about how we're going to address this crisis collectively and in a more coordinated fashion. There should be discussions, obviously, with also countries who, you know, are beyond our direct region. Countries like the US, for example, countries like Australia, countries, Australia is, of course, in the region, but countries who are concerned about refugees and who are concerned about the human rights of refugees and of people from Myanmar, and in particular the Rohingya. There should be a whole dialogue that's taking place about this, because it's, I think that, you know, what our governments are doing now is they're so afraid to act quickly to save lives because they're thinking about the consequences and the implications.
What are they afraid of, Lillian?
I think that they're afraid that they will not have a solution, that they will just end up being a pull factor. You know, more and more refugees will come because they can see that they got disembarked. And then there will be this expectation that every time, you know, that you just jump on a boat and basically take a boat over to, you know, country X, and they will save you. And I think that that's a very unfortunate kind of position to be in, where literally when you have lives at risk, you know, that should be the only priority right now. We should really be talking about saving lives first, and then trying to sort out all these other issues, whether it's immigration issues, whether it's status determination issues, whether it's looking at longer term solutions. But of course, those discussions need to happen as right. well. And I think the difficulty is that governments are reluctant to get into a humanitarian discussion without having all of those longer term implications really understood. Whereas, you know, for us with humanitarians, we just don't even question, because, you know, the argument that we're trying to make is, let's put aside the fact that these are Rohingya. These are lives at risk of death, basically, because they're in very desperate situations. And when there is a boat in distress with people on it, it should be rescued. There is an obligation to rescue it without discrimination. And we actually shouldn't be making a fuss because these are Rohingya people, or these are people who don't have, you know, status. Mm-hmm. It should be really about life-saving interventions for a boat that's in distress and people whose lives are at risk. That is what the conversation should be about.
So I take your point that, say, a country that doesn't have a comprehensive domestic refugee framework like Malaysia, is there a way to bridge the emergency humanitarian aid versus, you know, and having kind of safe disembarkation and procedures for that without having that framework already in place? Because it feels like by the time we're waiting for a comprehensive framework to be built and to be implemented, there will be so many lives lost in the process. Is there a way to bridge that?
There is a way, Melissa, and I think the way is what Indonesia's done. So Indonesia doesn't have a comprehensive framework on refugees either, but it does have a presidential regulation which allows for safe disembarkation, for rescue and safe disembarkation of refugee boats in distress. Not all refugee boats, not, you know, any refugee, but basically boats in distress. Basically, there is a protocol now on, you know, how you coordinate amongst government agencies, who is supposed to do what. You know, it goes all the way down to really giving clear guidance on particular, the way a particular situation should be managed, who should get involved, from the central government level down to the, provincial sub-district, district and sub-district level. So that is, it's being implemented already. Mm. But as you can see, there's even then, even with that presidential regulation, there's still reluctance. You know, we're still seeing reluctance right now on the part of Indonesia. And there are lots of other things in play. You know, they've seen that there's been a bit less welcome of the Rohingya refugees in Indonesia amongst communities now. So they're quite reluctant to make those commitments. You know, they would like to understand as well what commitments of the international community are going to be. So these are all things that have to be discussed. And I would say that if the countries in the region really put this a little bit higher on their priority list, they should be calling for a regional discussion on this, a regional, roundtable, particularly, you know, with Indonesia as the chair of ASEAN next year, Malaysia with a new government. There are still a lot of things that need to be sorted out in terms of how these issues are handled. So I do think that we should be calling for, the same way that in 2015, Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia actually had, you know, a kind of a tripartite discussion without getting the whole of ASEAN involved. But they met in Putrajaya and had three governments come to have a discussion on what are we going to do with these boats. So that's the kind of thing that should be happening right now.
All right. The last time we spoke, Lillian, you were secretary of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Malaysian Refugee Policy. I'm not sure if you still hold that position, but given that we have a new government, a new composition of Dewan Rakyat, and a new home minister, are you seeing a leaning towards that, a tendency to want to address that and build this comprehensive framework?
Well, it's still very early days, but I think what we do see is that the new government certainly wants to learn more about these issues, and there's an openness to engaging. I can't say more than that because we haven't had a real opportunity to engage directly on these issues for, you know, real substantive discussions yet. But we have had responses of interest, you know, and indications that, yes, there will be interest in discussing these issues. There is an interest to understand better, what the contexts are and what the problems are and listen to proposed solutions as well. So I think the openness for dialogue is there. I also feel that change is not going to come easily. And it won't come quickly. And it's not only because of, you know, what the new government in terms of, newly appointed ministers and cabinet would like to do, but there are much deeper institutional issues that also have to be dealt with as well. So I think that it is still a very long journey to get to where we want to be. But, in the meantime, these crises are going to keep happening and people's lives are going to continue to be at risk. So we can't wait until we have a perfect framework to start making things better in terms of the way we respond to crises.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. That was my conversation with Lillian Fan. She's the chair of the Rohingya Working Group at the Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.